Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Rachel was probably one of the most amazing people that I've ever met. I thought about it over and over in my head how I would say it so that it didn't just sound like, you know, the cheesy typical answer. But if you knew her, that's literally the only way that you can describe her. She was almost like what you would picture a Southern Belle to be. She's very country, very cutesy, sweet, always had a smile on her face. She just always looked really happy all the time. She was just awesome.
I got a phone call, I remember, by a mutual friend of ours. Her name's Terry. And she said, "Have you seen or talked to Rachel?" I remember telling them, no, I hadn't talked to her in 3 days. But they said that Amber, her daughter, woke up and she wasn't there. I didn't even go any further. I was like, we need to call the police because she would never just drop her daughter in the middle of the night without telling anybody. Like, that was just not who she was. She always put anything that she did was for Amber. Anything she did. So to me, something was wrong now. So we tried to call the police, and they told us that somebody had to be missing for 48 hours to be able to put in a police report. I don't think a lot of people believed her and what she was going through. So, and sometimes I feel like I even have a little bit of guilt because I feel like there's something I could have done, or what should I have done? Or
back in March of 2008, 30-year-old Rachel Conger had recently split up with her husband, Paul. Rachel and her daughter, Amber, moved to a new home in Como, Tennessee. Rachel borrowed a truck from a friend so she could move some furniture to her new place. On the evening of March 12, 2008, Rachel told her daughter that Paul was coming to stay the night. She said he was off of his medication and not acting right. Rachel told Amber that she was trying to keep him calm. She warned her daughter that if anything happened, for her to climb out the window and call for help. Rachel's daughter went to bed that night, and when she woke up the following morning, her mom and Paul were gone. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 216 of The Vanished, Rachel Conger's story. Everyone knows that finding the perfect t-shirt can be a challenge. I've always had problems whether it was with the fit or quality. Luckily, the perfect t-shirt does exist, and you can find it at Skims. From cropped silhouettes to long-sleeve layering tees, there's a style for everyone. You know that I've been wearing Skims for a long time, and recently tried one of their t-shirts. It's the best-fitting tee I've ever worn. Skims makes the best basics and foundations. I got the boyfriend t-shirt in Onyx, and it's so soft and comfortable. I want to wear it every day. It literally fits like a dream. Shop the Skims t-shirt shop at skims.com, now available in sizes extra extra small to 4X. If you haven't yet, be sure to let them know I sent you. After you place your order, select podcast in the survey and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows. Before we get into the details of Rachel's disappearance, we wanted to share more about who Rachel was as a person. We spoke with her mom, Louise, who told us more about Rachel's childhood growing up as the youngest child in the household.
Well, when she was a child, she was a little spoiled brat because her dad was quite a bit older. I knew that he wouldn't live long enough to see her grown, so I kind of pushed her to interact with him. And she did, and
They had a great time together. She was 13 when her dad died, but she was into everything. She was tomboy, riding bikes, breaking her thumb, just real active kid. She was always sweet. We wasn't like mother and daughter. We was like two kids together, I guess, more or less, and went everywhere and did shopping together and had a bunch of fun. Very close, especially to one. I have one that they would get out and play in the sand. He was 10 years older than she was, and he would get down and play in the sand with her. And but we got a little creek bank that runs through the property, and they get down there and play with boats and cars and all that stuff. All the whole family was really close. She made all A's when she was in school until the year her dad died, and then she just decided, no, this ain't for me. And so she gave the teacher a hard way to go, but she passed, but barely by the skin of her teeth. So the next year, when she started back to school, she was a totally different kid. And he told me, said, well, she just had to have time to adjust. While she was in the, 12th grade, she decided that she wanted a baby, so she got pregnant.
Rachel met her first husband, Joseph, in high school. The two would eventually marry. Here's Joseph.
I was trying to figure it out the other night. I know it was our ninth grade year, her ninth grade year, my 10th. And we met mutual friends, and we met on the school bus. One time we were dating other people at the time, but it was just, she was there. And then after everybody was single, our friends decided we needed to get together. And we dated for 4 or 5 years. I think we were married for a year. And then after the divorce, we, stayed friends for until everything happened.
As Louise mentioned, Rachel had gotten pregnant during high school. Sadly, her baby was stillborn. About 6 months later, she found out she was pregnant a second time with her daughter, Amber. After a difficult pregnancy and premature birth, Rachel and Joseph welcomed Amber into the world. By all accounts, Rachel was a doting mother. After the loss of her first child, she was in fear that something could happen to Amber. She worried about SIDS and would stay up all hours of the night to make sure her daughter was okay.
She told me, said, somebody's going to be awake with that baby all the time. When I'm in school, you watch her. And when I get out, you can sleep. And then I'll watch her hold up in the night. And we did that off and on till I like to went crazy. So I said, look, this is nonsense. Ain't nothing wrong with that baby. She's going to be all right. And she would go over, and the baby would be in the baby bed, sound asleep. And she would sit and watch her, make sure she was breathing. And then if she thought she wasn't breathing good enough, she'd go over and wake her up. And I said, you got to stop that. That's crazy. And so finally, she decided that, yeah, I was right.
We also spoke to Rachel's daughter, Amber, who was just 13 when her mom disappeared. She told us what she remembers about her mom's personality.
She was always super happy and super, like, bubbly as a person. She was kind of one of those people that if she could and had the availability, she would help anybody. I guess if I had to describe her in one word, I would just say that she was very giving and very caring. She loved animals. We were always, like, picking up animals that we found off the side of the road and stuff and trying to help them. And she's a very determined person, too. So she set her mind to something. That's just what it was.
Rachel was dedicated to providing for her growing daughter. And over the years, she worked various jobs to support her.
Oh, she worked all her life. I mean, she worked, like, for a grocery store, as a baker, just different places, and she landed this job. It was a fairly good job, but then her and Jody. That was her first husband's name. They got a divorce. Well, she was pulling in all the money and doing all the work, so they split. But it was a very good divorce. I meant they got along a whole lot better after they were divorced. He wasn't violent or anything like that. It was okay.
Amber was really young when her parents divorced, but remembers things between her parents being amicable after they had split.
I was probably about a year old. I don't really ever remember her and my dad being together. They maintained a pretty good relationship after getting divorced. You know, I never had that weird go-between with my parents about custody or anything like that. My dad was always involved in him and my mom. You know, they like to tell me that they were just young and they remained friends after, so.
After the breakdown of her first marriage, Rachel reconnected with a childhood friend named Paul.
She met Paul when she was a kid. She was about, she was about 8 or 9 years old. The church had this camp out in a backyard of one of the residents that lived out there. And that's where she met Paul at. Paul was, you'd have to meet him to really get the grasp of what he was like. He was, one minute, he was like just super guy, and he was really nice, and he treated her good and everything. The next 2 or 3 minutes, something clicked in his head, and he was a teetotal different person. He would slap her, knock her around, choke her, things like that. So he'd bring her stuff up to my house, dump it in the driveway, and he was violent with her.
Rachel and her first husband remained friends, despite the breakdown of their marriage. Joseph told us that he wasn't a huge fan of Paul. However, he tried to keep their interactions pleasant, so that things would go smoothly since he and Rachel shared custody of their daughter.
Well, he gave off the impression of being, you know, just that, you know, the funny, helpful guy. Now, I wasn't overtly fond of him because I was just situation, you know, and stuff like that, but we didn't not get along.
Louise told us that she remembers Paul's explosive temper, even dating back to childhood.
My son went to school with him. My son went out, called me on the phone, and said, Mom, can I visit with Paul this weekend? And the church is just a walking distance from his house. And I said, well, sure. And he said, because I had known him. And so I said, yeah, you can go. Behave yourself now and all that stuff, you know, what mothers normally say to their kid. Okay, so he calls me. He went on a Friday, got off school bus at his house on Friday. Saturday morning, he calls me bright and early. He says, Mama, get out of here. Get out of here now. Come and get me. I'm coming home. I said, what's wrong? He said, I'll tell you when you come and pick me up. And don't pick me up at the house. Pick me up down the road a little bit. I said, okay. So I went and picked him up. I figured they'd got into an argument like boys do. No, he had gotten mad at something his mama said and drove the car through the house. Drove the car into the house. I tend to believe I've known his mother for a long, long time, and she was scared to death of that boy.
Paul didn't always feel the need to hide his abuse from others. Louise says she witnessed it on many occasions.
I heard them arguing. Rachel and Paul arguing in a room. Well, I heard a thud against the wall, so I thought, I'm going to see what this is about. I walked in. He had her up against the wall and had his knee in her chest where she couldn't holler, and he was choking her. I said, you better turn her loose, and I meant right now. And the bed was right behind him. He just turned her loose, threw her on the bed, and told her, said, get some clothes on. She had her night clothes on. So get some clothes on. We're taking her home.
Not only was he abusing Rachel, But he had been cruel to Amber, too.
Amber was just small, I guess about 2 by 8 years old. And the dog come across, and there, he had a little concrete slab that went into the house they lived in. It was his porch, he called it. And the dog pooped on the porch, and he told her to go out and get that up and go throw it in the gully. Well, she went out and got it up, and instead of throwing it in the gully, she throwed it across the road in a gully, in a little ditch. He made her go out there and look for every piece of that until she found it all and to take it to the gully like he had told her to begin with. Well, I was at their house, and we had planned on going to the Land Between the Lakes for the day and having a picnic lunch out. And I turned around because I was mad. I was furious with him. And I turned around and told him, I tell you one thing, you take me home and take me home right now.
Amber recalls from her perspective as a child that there were two sides to Paul, the nice one and the abusive one.
When I was really young, I guess I always thought of him as really fun. He was always trying to take us on some kind of grand adventure or we camped. We were always out in Land Between the Lakes National Forest. It was really close to our house, and we had campers' tents, like the whole nine. So we pretty much lived out there half the time. We were always hiking. He always wanted to do, you know, nature-y stuff, fun stuff like that. But I guess it was hard because he was kind of like a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde kind of person. Because when it was good, it was really good. But when it wasn't, it was really bad. He was just extremely, extremely abusive. You know, he would just kind of change. And then he would be really aggressive and mean. And you know, if you said the wrong thing to him, he would get really explosive. And he never really hit me, but he would hit my mom. I found out, obviously, as an adult, he had bipolar disorder. When he wasn't on his, like, medication and stuff like that, it was worse. Obviously, you know, little stuff that would make him mad would just make him completely irate. When he was on his medication, everything was usually pretty kosher and pretty cool. But when he wasn't, that's when, you know, things would get kind of rocky and he could just, the wind could probably blow wrong and he would get irate about something.
Not only was Paul abusive to the people in his life, he also had a history of harming animals, too.
We actually had to get rid of this. We had a golden retriever. It ate some of his chickens. He actually was very violent towards the dog and almost beat it to death, but my mom was able to find it a home to go to.
According to the National Domestic Violence Hotline, on average, it takes a woman 7 attempts to leave an abuser before leaving for good. And there are various reasons for this. We also know that leaving an abuser is the most dangerous time for a victim. Amber remembers a few times when she was young that her mom had tried to leave Paul, but they would end up getting back together.
I guess this would be the time that law enforcement got involved. We went to the local sheriff's department. We stayed in like a secret house or something like that. I don't know exactly what it would be called. Like a battered woman house. We stayed there for maybe 3 months before we went back. There were quite a few times where we left for a few days or a week. That was probably the longest time that we had left up at that point when I was younger.
At the time of her disappearance, Rachel was working at a local club as a dancer. Louise says that Paul was using this money that Rachel earned to buy extravagant things.
Everybody knows that she was dancing, but everybody don't know that he was the one that wanted her to do it. He was the one that was getting the most money out of it, and he was not mad about that. He was thrilled with it because he was spending like crazy and buying way over their means. I meant way over their means. Like, he bought a brand new motorcycle. And he wrote it up out here, and he said, look what I got for Rachel for her birthday. I said, her birthday is in October. And he said, oh, well, it don't matter. She's going to pay for it anyway.
Amber told us that her mom had worked various jobs over the years and how she came to be a dancer closer to the time of her disappearance.
She'd worked for a meat processing place for a very, very long time. And then it was, a male-dominated society, and she felt she wasn't getting a raise she was promised and was tired of working there. So she stopped working there and was doing construction work with my stepdad because he owned his own business. That kind of spiraled out of control just because working with him was not easy. And then, with his tendencies, that Christmas, or like a year before everything kind of happened, we left and I stayed with my dad that Christmas, and she was staying in like a homeless shelter for women, but maybe a month, and just driving back to see me. And I just was told not to tell anybody, but she started dancing at that time. She continued doing that after, because I guess from what I understand, my stepdad purchasing things like big trucks, bulldozers, her having a nice car and stuff like that, they got into quite a bit of debt. He had her to continue doing that because of the money that it was bringing in. He followed her down there a lot, and I guess he would hang out while she was working. I don't know. She had planned to go back to college, though. She didn't like stripping. It wasn't for her. She didn't like the environment. Some of the people that she worked with, she, maintained good friendships with. She wanted to go back to school. She'd actually been, like I said, all of our family maintained a pretty good relationship. She'd been talking to my Aunt Lori, which is my dad's sister, about how to do online school and stuff like that. It was something that she was trying to figure out how to, work the computer properly and figure out how to do all of that.
While working on the story, we had the chance to speak with one of Rachel's friends, Maggie. Maggie met Rachel around this Christmas when she had made an attempt to leave Paul. Maggie told us more about how she and Rachel met and became close friends.
We met at a nightclub. I can't remember if it was right before Christmas or right after Christmas. I worked there, and she started, so we met at work. I was not from Tennessee. I was originally from Ohio, and I would just go up to anybody I would meet and just start conversations, and it just became so naturally that we ended up being really good friends. We talked every night, and we just got really close really quick, and I couldn't explain how it happened, but we were both the same kind of people person, if that makes sense. I think she always put everybody first. She was quiet at first and maybe a little shy, but as soon as you got to just meet her or get to know her, really, she was probably the funnest person I've ever been around in my entire life. But she could be very serious if she needed to be serious, and she was a really good mom, and she was one of my best friends. It was hard. I've never found a friend like her. She was just caring is an understatement of how she felt towards her friends. And so when I had first met her, she had actually had ran away from Paul, and she was living in and out of a women's shelter. It was either right after Christmas or right before Christmas. And I remember she had told me that she got her daughter a hairbrush for Christmas and a comb because that was all that she could afford at the time. And I remember telling her, it doesn't matter as long as you're there. I remember a vivid conversation about this hairbrush that she was buying for her daughter for Christmas. I had heard stories about him, but they always ended with, but he's fine if he's on his medicine. He'll be fine if he just stays on his medicine. If he ever changes his medicine, that's a different story.
Amber mentioned earlier that there were these two very different sides to Paul. While this may be difficult to imagine after hearing about how he had abused Rachel, Maggie says that she saw what she thought was the good side of Paul, which she now believes was just a front.
I do remember the first day I met him, and I remember thinking that Rachel was beautiful. She's gorgeous. She was with this older man, and I thought to myself, love is love, and sure, that's want to be with and without judging, because I would never judge anybody, but I do remember being shocked, like, wow, okay. And that quickly went away. And he became a very important person in my life, too. I mean, we would go out to dinner. Rachel stayed the night at my house every weekend because she had lived far away from where we worked, and her daughter would stay the night at our house, and Paul would come and visit and stay. He helped us move one time. And to me, he was always a very nice man. And I would have never thought anything. I had heard that he was abusive previously, but from what I had saw of them, that he actually treated her really good. And it was a big front. He was just very easy to manipulate anybody to make him believe that he was somebody that he wasn't. If that makes any sense, it was very hard for me to see a bad side of him, but I was young too. And I feel like I was so naive. I mean, now that I'm 33 years old, I can see so many signs that I just wish I would have seen. And sometimes things just haunt me, like the way he would talk to her, the obsessive phone calls. I remember one night that she was at my house that he had called her 9 times within 9 minutes. And if she didn't answer, she would walk out of the room to talk. And these are things that you shouldn't have to do with your husband. I feel like I was just young and blinded by that.
Rachel got to the point where she was ready to leave this life with Paul behind. She felt like she had to get her daughter out of there. She told her mom about her plans and also that she was scared.
The police had been called out to the house a lot of times for him beating her. And so she decided she was leaving him, and she called me on the phone and she said, "Mama, I'm fixing to leave Paul, but he will kill me. I'm telling you, he will kill me. But I am not going to put my daughter through this anymore. I'm going to leave him." And she left. And then that's when all the trouble really started, because he told her, "If you ever leave me, I'll kill you." And he did.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. When Rachel left Paul shortly before she disappeared, she moved out of their shared residence in Paris, Tennessee, and stayed with a friend briefly before renting a house for herself and Amber in the nearby town of Como. Amber remembers that in the lead up to her mom leaving him, things seemed to escalate, and there was one event that was the final straw for Rachel.
I had some friends over. I guess the garbage had gotten blown over or something like that, and he started screaming at me and like calling me names and stuff like that and telling me to pick it up. And I was like, oh, I didn't even know anything about this. You know, you don't have to talk to me like that. And I mean, I was pretty young, so obviously I guess there's a little bit of attitude towards that. But he just got completely irate and started throwing things. And my mom came outside and tried to intervene. He got really upset and told us to get out. He was going to kill our dog, all of that. So we got the dogs. We got in the car. I guess something kind of snapped because I was telling him how much I hated him and screaming. I don't know. You could just kind of see it in his eyes like a wild animal or something. And when we left that day, he actually chased the car down the road. Yeah, we didn't come back after that. That's when my mom went ahead with getting her own house and stuff like that.
After Rachel left Paul and had found a place for her and Amber, a friend was helping her get set up in her new home.
We had recently moved into this other house. I guess she was still trying to get some of her stuff from him. And she was also borrowing a truck from one of her friends, Doug Brown. He'd given her some stuff so we would have like some couches and stuff like that when we moved.
Louise told us about the last conversation she had with Rachel before she disappeared.
Well, first of all, I called her on a Monday, and she answered the phone, and I talked to her, and she said, I don't know how things are going. She said I got to be very careful. I got to walk like I'm walking on ice, because if I don't, he'll kill me and Amber and burn us up in the house, and said, I have got to be very careful.
On Wednesday, March 12th, 2008, Amber remembers spending much of the day at a friend's house who lived just a few doors down from their new home. It was a half day before their spring break from school.
My friend lived a few houses down from me at the time when we moved to this home, and I'd saw him over there, but after the big explosion that I mentioned earlier, I hadn't spoken to him at all. So she'd went over to his house to get some more stuff. And a lot of the reports had said they'd been trying to reconcile, but they weren't trying to reconcile. I guess that's something that's false news. Because she was trying to get some of her stuff from him. He was withholding to try and string her along, I guess.
So Rachel was going over to Paul's that day with the truck she had borrowed from her friend Doug. She was attempting to retrieve her belongings from Paul. This is when Amber says things took a frightening turn.
I didn't hear from them and it was getting dark. And I got nervous because I knew that she told me he'd been acting really crazy. He's off his medication. I tried calling her and he answered the phone. He's like, let me just have your mom for one night. And I said, no, you can't. You can't have her over there. I need my mom. Like, y'all, she needs to come get me. Put her on the phone. They showed up back to the house, and I walked back over from my friend's house, and she pulled me to the side. He dropped her off and said he had to run back to his house. I'm not sure why or anything like that. My mom told me when he was gone, she said, you know, he's acting really crazy. He said he's going to burn the house down with us in it if I don't try to talk to him tonight and fix this. So if you hear anything during the night, crawl out of your window and go call the police. So I fell asleep. When I woke up that morning, nobody was home. And that was weird because I knew my mom had to work that night. Me, her, and one of my friends were supposed to go to Clarksville, Tennessee while she was at work, and we were going to babysit for one of her friends, because they both worked together. And then we were going to kind of, you know, go to the mall and stuff like that. It was spring break. I thought, you know, I was left home alone before. I was old enough, so maybe she went to the grocery store or something like that. But I don't know, something just felt off because, like, the back door wasn't closed. The screen door was just closed, which is weird. She would have typically left me a note and locked everything up. So I guess that night was the last time I saw her. But, I was able to tell her, you know, good night, I love you. So I feel good about that. And I guess the next day, I went over to my friend's house. I kind of, you know, told her that my mom wasn't home yet, so we should watch some movies and stuff like that. As the day crept on, I kept trying to call her, and she didn't answer. You know, I tried calling Paul's cell phone. He didn't answer. So I pretty much called everybody I knew, even down to her job, to see if anybody had seen her. Because at this point, that's 100% unlike her. Me and my mom, we were very close. You know, we went shopping together. I was her only child. So, you know, we were not just her parenting me, making sure I was okay, but, you know, I thought of her as, like, my best friend, someone I could tell anything to, and she wasn't there, and I knew how he was. You know, there was lots and lots of times where he was really awful to her when I was a kid. He hid it well, you know. Apart from his family, no one knew he was abusive, because he was the type that was around in the community after, like, tornadoes and stuff like that, and cut up trees and clear the way for people. So people just didn't think that he was like that.
Amber woke up on the morning of the 13th and couldn't find her mom or Paul anywhere. Amber tried looking everywhere she could think to see if anyone had seen her mom. When all those ideas came up empty, it was time to go to the police.
I went and saw my dad. Typically, it was close to the weekend. I thought maybe she'd went and picked up some money from him or something for child support. I felt like I was grasping at straws, because I doubted he had seen her, but I didn't know who else to go to. I was like, hey, have you seen her? And my stepmother hadn't seen her either. My mom liked to maintain a really good relationship with everybody. So, you know, her and my stepmom were friends as well. No one had seen her. And actually, after that, my friend's mom that I was hanging out with took me to the police department to report her missing. The sheriff is a great guy, but the police officer I dealt with really did not make me feel comfortable at all. He was very skeptical. He knew Paul and, you know, said, hey, well, whenever she gets back, you need to let us know, because that's child endangerment and stuff like that. For the first time ever, I admitted out loud to another person, you know, he's really abusive. I'm scared for her.
Rachel's friend Maggie recalls how she learned that Rachel had disappeared.
I got a phone call, I remember, by a mutual friend of ours. Her name's Terry. And she said, have you seen or talked to Rachel? I remember telling them, no, I hadn't talked to her in 3 days. But they said that Amber, her daughter, woke up and she wasn't there. I didn't even go any further. I was like, we need to call the police, because she would never just drop her daughter in the middle of the night without telling anybody. Like, that was just not who she was. She always put anything that she did was for Amber. Anything she did. So to me, something was wrong now. So we tried to call the police, and they told us that somebody had to be missing for 48 hours to be able to put in a police report. And I just knew that at the time she was leaving Paul, and I just knew it wasn't right.
Maggie mentioned their mutual friend Terry, who was also a coworker. We had the opportunity to speak with her as well. Terry remembers feeling like, initially, the police weren't taking her disappearance seriously because Rachel was a dancer.
People are very judgmental about it, but I can remember when it was first going on and me and Amber were trying to talk to the police about it, they would not take us seriously because she was a dancer. They made that perfectly clear, and they were like, oh, well, how do you know she didn't just go home with another customer? I'm like, because I know her. You know, I was in a dead panic because I knew something was wrong. As soon as Amber called me, I knew something was wrong, and I had a panic attack. And I was trying to, like, express the urgency because, you know, they had just left my house because they were staying with me when she left Paul. And, you know, it was like right after they left my house, Amber called to see if she was with me. And I was like, no. And immediately I started freaking out because Rachel was the type of mom, she was 100% devoted to Amber. Like, she was going to be there to get her on the school bus. She was going to be there to get her off the school bus. And there was nobody or nothing that would had ever stopped that. So as soon as Amber called me, I knew that something was wrong. They basically were like, well, you have to give it, you know, so many hours before you can make a missing persons report. And then that's when they were like, oh, well, you know, she could have left with somebody else, or she could have met off with somebody else, you know, something like that. And we're just kind of like, no, we know her better than that.
Amber told us that since her mom had borrowed that truck from her friend and was due to return it, she believes that maybe her mom and Paul left that morning with the intent of going to do just that when things took a different turn.
The gentleman she was borrowing the truck from, Mr. Doug Brown, they had to return the truck to him. And he was a friend that had been friends with both of them, from what I understand, from a few years back. They had to take the truck back to him. So I guess my assumption would be that they were going to Clarksville to get my mom's car and take his truck back. From what I've understood, and with, you know, the back door and everything being left open, they left pretty hastily that morning. I guess the neighbor accounts from the police report said that it looked like they left pretty hastily, like she banged on the side of the truck because he was trying to pull away or something. My guess would be they were taking the truck back, but I'm not 100% sure. The area they were in would have been like the Land Between the Lakes area, because they had to go that way to get to Clarksville. That's probably where the cell phone ping came from, the Swan Bay Tower, because they would have been in that area to potentially be taking that truck back to Clarksville.
Just like every story, we put in a records request for Rachel's file. We were lucky this time because the Henry County Sheriff's Department granted our request. By reviewing her file, we were able to learn a lot about the police investigation. When the police did begin investigating Rachel's disappearance, they spoke to a man who lived across the street from Rachel and Amber's new home in Como. He said that he was watching Fresh Prince that morning, and he remembers seeing Rachel and Paul sometime between 7:30 and 9 a.m. He saw Paul exit the home and get into the truck that needed to be returned. He then saw Rachel come out, and she knocked on the passenger door like she wanted to be let in. He said they left heading in the direction of Paris, Tennessee. At 8:04 a.m. on the morning of Rachel's disappearance, Paul had called his cousin and said that his work plans had changed and that he was going to Clarksville to return a truck. This is the last incoming or outgoing call from Paul's phone. A friend of Rachel's, named Steve, attempted to reach her at 9:33 a.m. Just as Rachel was going through a breakup, Steve was having some marital issues too, and he wanted to set up lunch with her so they could talk. However, Rachel didn't answer the phone. Instead, Paul answered and sounded upset that Steve was calling his wife. Steve knew about Paul abusing Rachel. She had confided in him about it and told him Paul had even pushed her out of a moving vehicle. She had told Steve that she was afraid that if she ever left Paul, he would kill her. Because of this danger, Steve tried to play it off like he had the wrong number and asked for Bobby. Steve was under the impression that when he called Rachel, that his number came up as restricted, when in fact, it did come up as Steve, which may have angered Paul. The next sighting that morning came from a neighbor of Paul's at 10:15 a.m. She said that she was leaving her home and saw him outside standing next to his horse trailer looking at a tire. After that, Paul was seen by his brother at 11:45 a.m. Paul was still driving that same truck that was due to be returned. His brother said that Paul was acting evasive, which was out of character for him. He would usually chat with his brother whenever he saw him. That evening is when Rachel was reported missing. The following morning, Rachel's friend Doug went to the sheriff's office to see what he could do about his truck. He was concerned because he couldn't find Rachel or the truck. He explained the whole situation about switching vehicles with her so she could move some of her belongings. He also noted that Rachel had not shown up for work the night before, which was out of character for her. Several officers went over to Rachel's home and didn't find her or note anything out of the ordinary. Next, they went to Paul's and noticed his personal truck was there with the keys inside of it. They went inside, and again, nothing was out of the ordinary. After this, they decided to ping Paul and Rachel's phones. They realized that Steve calling Rachel's phone and Paul answering it was the last call, and after that, Rachel's phone was turned off. Paul's phone record showed the last call being the one he had with his cousin, and then his phone was off after that time, too. The following morning, the sheriff decided it was time to obtain a search warrant for Paul's home and property. They also decided to do a flyover of the area near Paul's residence. That is when they spotted the truck that Rachel had borrowed from her friend Doug. It was in a woodline approximately a quarter mile from Paul's home. At the time, they called out a search team to look for both Rachel and Paul in the vicinity of where the truck was found. That search came up empty. During the search of Paul's home, they didn't find any clues as to where they could be or what may have happened to Rachel and Paul. They took a pair of coveralls from Paul's truck for further testing because they looked like they could have had blood stains on them. On Sunday morning, Paul's family called the sheriff's department to report that they'd found Paul. He was around 400 yards from where they recovered the truck. Paul's death was ruled a suicide, and he had died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the face. For the rest of the day, they continued their searches for Rachel in that area. Paul's family assisted in the search into the lake area by giving investigators information about where Paul liked to go camp and fish. This information coincided with the area of Rachel's last known cell phone ping being on the Swan Bay Tower. They searched well into the night, but no trace of Rachel was found. Several different agencies came in to assist in the search for Rachel, and they continued those searches throughout the week. They tested the truck using luminol and didn't find any blood evidence inside. With Paul dead and investigators desperate for new leads on where to search for Rachel, they turned to local businesses to see if they could find Paul, Rachel, or the truck on surveillance video. On March 27th, a new tip came in. Someone who knew Paul called in and said that they had seen Paul on Friday the 14th, which would be the day after Rachel disappeared and the day prior to the truck being recovered. This man was sure that he had seen him on that day because he worked 4 10-hour days and had Friday off. He said that he was walking to his mailbox when Paul drove by in a silver Ford truck and waved. He said he was certain it was Paul because he's known him for many years. Initially, they had thought that Paul had done something to Rachel on Thursday morning and then took his life shortly thereafter. This new lead extended the time frame out even longer, with Paul being alive on Friday and found deceased on Sunday morning. What could he have done to Rachel? And how far could he have gotten in that amount of time before returning to take his own life? On Monday, March 31st, 2008, the searches for Rachel were suspended until they had new leads on where to search. They had exhausted all of the places they thought she could be. Investigators began digging into financial records for both Rachel and Paul. They learned that just 2 days prior to Rachel's disappearance, the two had gone to the bank together in order to change their joint accounts to separate accounts. The bank employee noted that they seemed in good spirits and neither seemed to be upset. Paul and Rachel's accounts had not been used since that day. We can't be exactly certain when Paul took his life and how much time he would have had to conceal what he had done to Rachel. Amber thinks that Paul felt like they were closing in on him after the truck was found.
He had, I guess, changed clothes from the outfit I last saw him in, so he had time to do that. He killed himself. I guess I don't think he expected me to be as on top of things as I was with involving the police. Where he was positioned and the gun that he used it had a really good scope on it. So I feel like maybe he saw the walls closing in, so to speak, because there were police officers searching and looking for them and stuff like that. And from where I was told he was found, he would have had an ample opportunity to look through like different fields to be able to see that people were looking for him. If he did kill her, even if he was really abusive and crazy, he may have felt some kind of remorse. I don't know. I really don't even like to give that much. I think it was a lot of it was about control. If I can't have her, no one can. And I think by hiding her body and, you know, making it where her remains weren't even going to be able to be found, I feel like that was his way of having control over everything. And then he killed himself, not having to, again, give up control.
Amber has gone back and forth over the years on whether or not she believes that this was something that Paul planned, or if he just had a violent outburst and killed her mother.
You know, that's something that's really hard for me to say either way, because I guess that's something over the years I've went back and forth with. I'd like to think that he just lost control and it wasn't premeditated. He was a pretty calculated person. So part of me feels like he knew he'd lost her and that wasn't acceptable. And it was either get her back or she's got to die. I don't like to think he was that malicious of a person, but I wouldn't put it past him, especially if he wasn't in a solid state of mind. But I guess another part of me thinks that potentially he got upset with her maybe when the phone call happened and lost control.
One of the difficulties in the search for Rachel is that Paul was a man who knew the land. He loved to hunt, fish, and camp, and grew up doing all of these things in the local area. There are various different places that he could have taken Rachel.
I think him knowing the area really helped him, because he grew up, like the house that we lived in, he grew up in. You know, that's one of the locations they think she could potentially be at, and the other is at Land Between the Lakes National Forest, which is huge. And like I said, we camped there my entire childhood. It's somewhere that he grew up camping at. My mom grew up camping at. You know, the lake is super deep. There's a lot of area around there. So, I mean, and there's also old like wells and stuff like that. Because I know we used to have one underneath our house that we had to get an animal out of one time because it had fallen in there. So, I mean, part of me thinks potentially he could have known where, like, an old well is and put her body there in the lake or something like that. I think they also checked his work site because he owned a bulldozer. So, I mean, even that is something that could be a factor.
While they were searching for Rachel, they called in several agencies to assist. And then they did a search where they asked for volunteers, and about 300 people showed up to help. Amber and her family continued to find ways to conduct new searches when those searches would turn up empty.
They did one large community search, and then, of course, they did the dogs and stuff like that. Over that summer of 2008, I did a bunch of fundraisers with my family. We rose a few thousand dollars and brought in 3 different search teams at different times to conduct searches at both his house and the Land Between the Lakes area.
Rachel's friend Maggie remembers going out to search for Rachel.
They searched everywhere. I know they were searching his property. We drove up there, a bunch of friends. I think I got anybody I could to get together, and we drove there, and they were picking people up by school bus load to go and do these searches. And they had ATVs and they had dogs and horseback, people on horseback. We just all searched and searched through these woods. And they showed us at that time that they had found the truck, and they had found it, and they said that they hadn't found any keys. So at the time, we were looking for any evidence of Rachel, anything. And we were also looking for keys. At this time, too, of the search, they had already found him deceased And we searched for a long time, for hours on foot until it got dark. We just walked through the woods, and I remember I had picked up a walking stick. I would look under things, and I even remember calling an officer over because I had found what looked to be like hair, and it got rolled out as it was deer hair. And it was very emotional. I remember I couldn't eat.
Terry also helped out with the searches and remembers the mixed emotions that she felt.
One crazy part of it was the search. Oh my goodness. When we did the first search, oh my goodness, I was a nervous wreck. There were so many mixed emotions about that because it was like on one end, like I really, really wanted to be able to find her. But on the other hand, I was really, really scared that I was going to find her. I mean, and then just being there with everybody, like, it was intense. Intense.
After Rachel disappeared, Louise recalled a strange interaction she had had with Paul in the past that she thought could help the police find Rachel.
He was working for Fort Campbell. It's an army base. He came in and he had four green bags that said U.S. Army on them in the back end of the truck and some old jars and stuff. And he told Rachel, I was at Rachel's, and he told her to unload them. Well, she picked up one end of that bag and it was too heavy. She couldn't unload it by herself. I said, wait a minute, I'll help you. I picked it up and it was either three or four of them. I didn't know what they were. And he says, do you know what that is? I said, no, I don't have any idea. And he said, those are body bags. I said, they're what? And he said, body bags. And he said, they got powder on the inside of them that you can put person in and dig a hole and put that down, sprinkle that powder on them, and never be found. He said, that's the way they do in the army and then mark it and then come back later and pick up the body. Maybe that's what he did.
Louise has thought a lot about where Rachel could be. She thinks about the place where Paul chose to take his own life and things that he had said over the years.
Well, me and the police department have a total different idea. I think Briar Patch Lake. That's a little old lake that ran behind their house, because I tell you what, he went up on a hill and shot himself, but he was facing, the way he was, his back was against the tree. Rachel had bought him a turkey gun. They're more powerful than a shotgun. He put it between his feet, put a piece of wood in there and pulled the trigger. Okay, and so he was facing to where he could see his house, his mama's house, his brother's house, and that lake down there. He always said when he was talking, you know, we watch these shows where they kill people on, you know, and they find their bodies and stuff. He said, well, I'll tell you what, if I was going to kill somebody and bury them, I'd put them in a well. So, police tend to think that last ping on that tower they got off that phone is where he killed her over the land between the lakes, because now he was working over there with a bulldozer. But the thing of it is, if he had been wanted to, he would have killed her and took her wherever he wanted to. Because that's just the type of person he was. It did nothing fazed him.
Rachel's friend Terry explained what she thinks happened between Paul and Rachel on the day of her disappearance.
You could just tell he was just so obsessed with her. When they said that he had killed himself, in my head, like, I just knew it. My theory of it was that he was trying to get her to come back to him, and he was abusing her as usual, trying to beat her into submission. And I think that he hit her too hard, or hit her one too many times and accidentally killed. That's how obsessed he was with her.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. For this story, we were able to work with the Henry County Sheriff's Department. Not only did they grant us access to her missing persons file, but we were also able to interview Sheriff Monty Ballew.
I've just always had a desire to be in law enforcement. I worked for Jackson PD, beginning my career in law enforcement, and then I was a Tennessee State Trooper for several years, and then I was elected sheriff about 13 years ago. My saying is, I always say, it's not what you do, but it's who you are. You don't get into law enforcement to get rich, or you don't get into law enforcement for a lot of other reasons, because you have a true desire to help people. Whether helping is arresting the bad guy, or helping the elderly lady across the road, or helping somebody getting their groceries out, whatever it may be, that's and there's no assignment that we won't take.
Sheriff Ballew walked us through what he remembers from those early days in this investigation.
We had received a call. Her family and friends had thought that she was missing. So we initiated an initial investigation for a day or two. Really didn't turn up much. As time passed, we realized that something's really up. Something, even though we don't have anything yet, we know something is awry here. And then it became apparent that there had been some domestic issues in the past with her husband. We realized that they had a separation at that time. She was working out of county. That morning of the disappearance, she had actually gone somewhere with her husband, or soon-to-be ex-husband, I guess, at that time. And that's where it kind of all started. Patrol usually goes out, does the initial investigation. And then we were obviously logged them into the database, NCIC, and enter them as a lost person, missing person. And then it goes from there, depending on, what information we get from the family or, what may turn up. It could go a lot of different ways, just depending. I think we had tried to contact a few friends as well as family members. We went to the scene of where she was living at this time because she was separated from her husband, talked to the neighbors there as well, and then also contacted some of the people that she was working with. To see if, obviously, they had seen or heard from her, knew of where her whereabouts might be. We'd involved some canine units, and then we'd also involved two different helicopter units. One of the helicopters actually spotted the vehicle that was in a ravine that had ran down into a ravine, an obvious attempt to hide it. And it wasn't very far at all, just across a field, basically, from where their residence was when they were married, when they were living together, where the husband was still living. Some of this ravine type deal had a lot of kudzu in it, which is a real tall, you know, vine that very thick. And I think some of it had been cut over too, some of the timber. So he'd basically gone down on like a little logging road type deal and run it off in some kudzu. Well, the helicopter spotted it, and then we went basically and obviously searched it and ultimately wound up processing it. Some of her belongings were still in there. So we knew she had been in the vehicle. But there weren't any types of, I mean, it was wrecked in a ditch, so we really couldn't see, you know, we couldn't say there was, you know, there was no blood in the vehicle. There was no obvious signs or in the bed of the truck, no blood or anything along that line that would lead you to believe that something traumatic has happened in there. But obviously something has, because her purse and some other belongings were still in there, but she's gone and he's gone. So at that time, we expanded the search and started searching that perimeter. And that perimeter search, and we brought in several volunteers. We had a group meeting where all volunteers through the community could help, multiple rescue squads, other sheriff's offices responded. The Tennessee Highway Patrol brought a search and rescue team as well.
When Rachel was reported missing and no one could locate Paul either, after they learned about him being violent, Paul immediately became a person of interest. Authorities wanted to track him down and question him. Those hopes were quickly dashed.
Ultimately, we found Mr. Conger over in a point of woods, and it appeared that he had passed away from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The gun was his, and it was a shotgun. He had basically laid down on sit down against a tree on a point of woods where you could see a good ways from there. And it was a beautiful view from there, and we figured he got there and collected his thoughts and realized what he had done and then ended it for himself. So at that time, you know, we processed that scene, our criminal investigation division, as well as TBI, I believe, assisted out there at the scene, Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. Then we began to start trying to put the pieces together to see where they had been. We, at that time, the investigators were doing a lot of cell phone work to see the phone calls that she had made and the phone calls that he had made to see what towers they had pinged off of and where they had been that day. The vehicle that she was driving had an oil change the day before that she had gone missing. So we were looking for an X number of miles. I can't remember the exact mileage off the top of my head, but it was only 60 to 75 miles that were missing that he could have gone with her. She was involved, I think, with some other people romantically at that time. And we don't know exactly where or when he may have found out about those other situations that she may have been involved in. So at some point during their trip to get this piece of furniture, we think it went awry. We think he killed her, and we think he did something with her. And then came home, realized what he had done, and then ditched the vehicle, and then killed himself. So with the mileage and then the cell phone investigations, we just started looking. We had search parties. We searched in Land Between the Lakes. We searched different places in Stewart County. And the entire community got involved in this. When I say, I mean everybody. We had multiple days where we searched, where we were arm in arm almost, doing grid searches out around where his body was found, as well as in LBL, ponds, several other locations. We've used everything from psychics to canine units to, you know, helicopter searches with FLIR units. And like I said, it was very encouraging the amount of people that came out from the community to help search. We searched the house again to where she was living.
Paul worked in construction, which gave him access to heavy equipment. That is one lead that investigators hoped would help them find Rachel.
He was working a construction site in an adjoining county where he had some heavy equipment. We didn't think he could have gone over there due to the mileage on the vehicle, but we went over there and searched that area and nothing, you know, no ground had been disturbed.
even though they believe that Paul killed Rachel before taking his own life, which means there's no way to seek justice in this case, they still continue to look at new avenues that might possibly lead them to recovering her remains.
We've had other colleges, had classes in the criminal justice field that have come in and gone over the case file, and then they have searched as well. We've had a lot of other people come in and review the case. I hired a retired state trooper to come in and to go over the entire case file, rehash everything that we did, and go re-interview people that we had interviewed. That didn't turn up anything. And make the long story short, we believe he killed her, did something with her body. She's never been found. We had thought at some point in time, either a deer hunter or a turkey hunter, someone would have stumbled across something that would lead us in the right direction, and that just never came around for us. We asked people to search their property as well. You know, landowners, if you own land, search your land. We just have no idea where she's at, and she's never turned up to this day. We have a lot of hunting that goes on in this county, as well as in Stewart County and Land Between the Lakes, LBL, which is a federal, it's a U.S. forest area, basically. You know, there's so much traffic on it from deer hunters, turkey hunters, hikers, backpackers, and things of that nature. You would have thought something would have turned up somewhere. We did a lot of searches of all the wells and cisterns that were in LBL. We had units checking a lot of those, either with the cameras or like pole cameras type deal where you lower them down. We have Kentucky Lake or the Tennessee River that they would have crossed that day, and they would have also crossed the Cumberland that day as well. So, you know, I don't know if she would have ever been put in the water. She just disappeared, you know, and obviously he did something with her, but we ain't got a clue where or how or what.
With Paul gone, Sheriff Ballou is hoping that someone out there may know something or possibly have seen something that they didn't realize was important. He urges anyone with information to come forward and help them bring Rachel back home to her family.
They can call just the Henry County Sheriff's Office. Our non-emergency number is 731-642-1672. They can remain anonymous. They can ask to speak to me or any investigator. And we would love any, you know, if you have some information that would lead to the recovery and help, you know, this family lay her to rest respectfully, we would love it. We would love the community's help, you know, and that's what it's going to take.
While speaking with Amber, we asked her if she thinks that her mom will ever be found.
That's kind of a hard question because, of course, I want to hold out hope and say, yeah, maybe someone will stumble across it. You know, stuff like that does happen. But I'm not waiting for it to happen. I've been able to find my own closure, you know, because a lot of people, how do you know she didn't leave you? I just know, you know, my mom wasn't that type of person. She loved me very much and valued our relationship because that's one of the reasons we didn't just jump states. She was worried that it would affect me being away from, like, my dad and my family, for us to just uproot like that. So I guess I don't think that her body will ever be recovered, but I do have that glimmer of hope that, you know, something happens that's out of my realm of control.
For Rachel's friend Maggie, she still struggles with the loss of her dear friend, who made such an impact on her during their short friendship.
I had gotten married. In between our friendship, we were friends for, I think, a year and 9 months. And in between that time, we lived in Tennessee and I was having a wedding in Ohio. And if this tells you how good of a person she was and what a friend, her and Paul were the only ones that came to my wedding from Tennessee. And still to this day, it's so hard for me to watch my wedding. I go through these phases where I can't watch my wedding videos. And then there's days where I just burn to watch them just to get a glimpse of her.
Louise told us how she feels about Rachel's disappearance today, and if she has hope that her daughter will ever be found.
It hurts me very, very much, and all the whole family, you know, because you don't feel like that you got any peace, any justice at all. But then finally one day I said, look, I go to church, and I tried to do what's right, and I said, well, God, I'm just going to let you have it because I don't know where she's at. I can't go find her. If I could, I would, but it's all in your hands now. That's the way I live it day by day, that it's all in your hands.
We know that Rachel and Amber had stayed with Terry temporarily after she left Paul and before she found a place to rent. Terry told us that she's still haunted because she had tried to convince Rachel to stay.
It sucks because when she decided to leave, the hardest part for a really long time, I had extreme night terrors. And I took it really hard because I felt like I should have pushed harder for her to stay. And Amber was even telling me, you know, tell my mom not to worry. I want to stay here. You know, I feel safe here. And I tried talking to Rachel about it. And I'm like, you know, don't worry about it. You're here. I know he's not going to touch you. I mean, my ex-husband, well, he was my husband at the time, but he was deployed. So it was just, you know, me, her, and our kids. And she wanted to leave because she was scared of bringing the drama to my house. But I was like, I'm not worried about it. Like, I sleep with a baton under my couch cushion and I sleep by the door. That's how I got through deployments. It was like a safety thing for me. I'm like, so if he comes in, he's not going to get the greeting he's going to think he is, you know? Don't worry about that. And she was like, well, I don't want to stress Amber out with her having to switch schools. And I'm like, no, you know, Amber isn't worried about that. You know, she doesn't want to leave. And then ultimately, you know, I had to step aside and let her leave. But it's like, it just sucked because I knew she was doing it to protect me, just wanted to protect her. And I just for a long time felt I would have just fought a little bit harder to get her to stay, that Amber would have still had her mom. And for the longest time after that, I was extra sensitive. If a dude even yelled at a female in public, oh gosh, like it was tough. Like you see about it on TV and you know that it happens, but it's like, it's crazy when it actually happens. You know, I met the man before. Never in my life would I have thought that he was capable of something to that measure. I didn't like him, but you know, it wasn't like immediate danger, red flags or anything like that.
Terry still keeps in contact with Amber and has watched her grow into a strong, successful woman, despite the trauma she faced at just 13 years old.
I have told her so many times how proud her mom would be of her because she hasn't let it hold her back on anything. She's working towards being successful. She's got a really great head on her shoulders. You know, I mean, she is a very, very intelligent, responsible young woman. And it just blows my mind, you know, because to go through something so traumatic at such a critical time in her life, you know, she was 13. You know, she's just getting into the teenagers where, like, you really, really need your mom at that point.
Amber told us that preserving her mother's memory is one thing that has helped her get through the trauma of losing her mom at such a young age.
Over the years, I've done some like speaking out against domestic violence and just sharing her story with people. And that's something that really helps me because, you know, if her story can help just one other person get out of a situation like that, maybe their kids won't have to, you know, lose their parent in that way because it really, it's going to shape my life for the rest of my life because it was something that was crazy because I don't have any children. That is something that I definitely think about, you know, how am I going to preserve her memory and not have them lose out on knowing something about their grandmother, the woman that shaped me to be who I am. You know, I count, you know, my independence, me being a strong person, me being very caring of others. I count all of those things to traits that she taught me. I guess that's kind of how I go forward. I know she wouldn't want me to be down and out, letting all of this put me in a position where I wasn't taking care of myself properly. So I guess I just try to make her proud of me, but also not let the trauma of my past and other people's decisions, her and Paul, shape how I'm going to live my life in the future. But it has definitely made me more aware of how you can be with someone for 10 years and they still end up killing you. So you always have to be cautious and make sure you're aware of your surroundings and who you're surrounding yourself with. People ask, well, if you say your mom was a strong woman, how did she end up staying with a man that treated her as awful as he did sometimes? And I think, like I said, when things were good, they were good. But when they were bad, they were just really bad. Because he would like leave her love notes hidden around the house and stuff like that. So I'm sure he was very charming. And she was, you know, almost 20 years younger than him, too. So I think that he played on having more life experience. I definitely think that he played on the fact that she was so caring and forgiving to his own advantage. You know, I changed, you know, I can be a better man for you. I remember knowing a lot more of that stuff as I got older, you know, from different times where an incident had happened and we left for a little while. He would start crying to me too, you know, forgive me. I can be a better father figure to you. You know, I love you guys. I don't want to lose you. And I guess I stopped feeling the sympathy for that stuff. It felt wrong to me, but I could see how she thought she could change him. She thought she could see that better man because she'd seen the good in him.
So what happened to Rachel Conger on March 13th, 2008? It seems very clear that her estranged husband Paul did something to Rachel that day. And whatever he did, he made it difficult to find her. Unfortunately, Paul took his life before anyone could get answers out of him. This has left investigators and her friends and family struggling to piece together the clues of where he was that day and what places he liked to frequent. We know that Paul was an avid outdoorsman, so it's likely that he was familiar with a lot of remote places. He also had access to large construction equipment. Piecing together all of those clues hasn't led to finding Rachel. Her story seemed to die out along with Paul, but her friends and family want people to remember Rachel. They want her to be remembered for who she was. They also want the world to learn from what happened to her. Maybe hearing Rachel's story could save someone from a similar fate. If you have any information about the disappearance of Rachel Conger, you're urged to call the Henry County Sheriff's Office at 731-642-1672. If you or someone you love is being abused, you can find resources at the National Domestic Violence Hotline at thehotline.org or by calling 1-800-799-7233. You can follow Rachel's case on Facebook at Bring Rachel Home.
It's something that I've learned a lot from, and I think I've changed on how I look at people ever since then, because, I mean, I can picture us at dinner and we were all just laughing and everything seemed fine. And then for this to happen, it's, you never know what's going on behind closed doors. I think Amber's a lot like her mom when it comes to being strong. I love Amber. Being with her when she's preteen and growing up and who she's turning into today. And I don't think I could do it she's just like her mom.
There's just so much that you could say, and, you know, what can I say that really, truly represents how Rachel really was? I mean, she was literally just like one of those people that you just couldn't help but feel blessed and inspired by, and especially like once you got to learn more of her history and like the things that she was going through, and just to maintain that kind of composure and smile through it, it was just insane, and still just be so sweet and not bitter about anything. So I definitely enjoyed seeing that personality trait in Amber, you know, because she also has just continued to smile and live her life and just be fruitful all the way around. I love it.
It's something that's always been very, very important to me throughout, you know, losing my mother is sharing her story. you know, letting it be known that there's a lot of stigmas that get attached to people. They didn't know she was having to strip or something like that, and then they find out that, oh, well, she's a bad person or something like that. You know, what somebody has to do doesn't make them a bad person. You know, what a situation they choose to stay in doesn't make them any lesser of a person. So I just think it's really important to share a story like her story so people know that just because you think you're not going to be taken seriously doesn't mean that you should put up with, you know, less than what you deserve. Her family deserves closure and to know what happened. And just because they may have been involved in things that not everybody agrees with, it doesn't mean it makes them any less of a loved person.
That brings us to the end of episode 216. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, CastBox, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from California. Thanks for listening.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all 6 episodes of Part 1 and watching along with Part 2 as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.